danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 179 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Las Vegas, Nevada. I am Andrew Brokus, joined by Nate Mavis in Somerville, Massachusetts.
How are you, Andrew?
Oh, I'm great. I just told you I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada, and it's June.
Yeah, that's a more reliable... That's more... That makes me more reliably happy than it makes you, I think, being in Las Vegas.
That's true, but I am actually happy.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. As we speak, you are between day one and day two of a tournament, and that's always a great feeling.
Yeah, it's nice. I don't have a huge number of chips. I'll be coming back to 12 big blinds, but that's only about one third of the average, which, I mean, may not sound like that much, but really it's, you get one double up and you're in good shape, and you get two double ups and you're ahead of the average. So I think it's important not to get discouraged. I've been grinding a short stack for the last few hours of day one, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. It was funny. I woke up this morning only knowing that you made day two, and I thought like, oh, well, Andrew's probably got huge piles of chips. Like, he's not the sort of person just to sit around making day two for the fun of it. And you have 3x starting, which is good. It's very fine. Well done. I'm sure you'll play the bubble correctly, and you won't just go punting off to because you're insecure about life or something, but yeah, I think your median result, given that you make day two, is a little bit different from this.
Yeah, this by the way is 1650 Venetian deep stack event, which I am.
Yeah, and that means you take today off also.
Yes, although I was actually thinking about this. I mean, I didn't. So we played until like 1:30 last night, and then I woke up at like 7:30 this morning, just because I suck at sleeping in. So I kind of wanted a day off anyway, because I've played every day since I've been here. So I wasn't actually real tempted to do this. But one thing that I've noticed, and Ryan LaPlante I know does this, and a few other people do as well, is I will sometimes see people, playing two tournaments that have the potential to conflict with each other. Like I think it's happened that Ryan has like made day two of a tournament that will play on, it's like the instance that I'm in, day two is going to play, we're recording today on Wednesday, day two is going to be tomorrow, Thursday. And there is a $1,500 no limit shootout event at the Rio today, which day two would also be tomorrow, Thursday. And I wasn't real tempted to play it for the reasons that I just gave, but at the same time, I am disappointed to miss it. And I was trying to think a little bit about how much would I really be, what would be the cost of entering that tournament? Particularly given that I don't have very many chips in the Venetian tournament, and I don't even know the structure on the shootout. But if, for instance, they were to play two of the shootout tables today, such that my chances of making day two in the shootout are pretty low, but if I were to make it, my expected value in that would probably be much higher than my expected value in the Venetian tournament is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't actually seem to me so unreasonable to play that tournament and just accept that if I make day two, I'll just play the shootout and let myself probably blind into the money in the Venetian. I think like we I believe have fewer than 10% of the people who started our day one B who made it through. So we must be pretty. I don't think they've announced the prize structure yet because they don't know how many people are going to play today day one C. But in all likelihood, we're extremely close to the money, so I would think it's likely that I could, even without playing a hand, fold into the money, which makes me think I wouldn't really be giving up that much by going to play the shootout.
Yeah. Yeah, so like if you play the shootout, if you make day two, what you lose is the value of your stack blinding probably into the money, as opposed to what you have actually playing it. And right now, your actual value in the tournament, let's call it $7,000. You have a 3x stack, but you're a crusher. So then your value, if you blind into the money, if you try to blind into the money, is maybe, what, 2K? What's a min cash?
Maybe more like 2,500 or 3K. I don't know for sure, but I think they may not even pay 10% of the field. Like I said, we lost more than... more than 90% of the players who played day one B. Yeah. So if they end up only paying like 8%, I would think a min cash would probably be more like 2x.
Yeah, but, and maybe on the one hand, you might not make it to the money. On the other hand, you might actually make it to like the 7 second pay level. There also might be a chance that the day two start is late enough where you could go pilot a pushbot stack for an hour before you go to the shootout. And like, I know you don't want to do really extreme things like that, but showing up to the Venetian, playing for an hour, then getting an Uber to the Rio is like not that big an imposition, I don't think. Yeah. So the loss there is something like $3,000 or $4,000, and it happens $3,000, and it happens maybe an eighth of the time. So 3,000 divided by 8, it's like $400. So you'd be adding like $400 a rake to the shootout. That's a lot.
Yeah, I think some of those estimates are off. I think, for one thing, I think it matters a lot what is the likelihood that I make it to day two of the shootout. So I would definitely want to find out, and again, I'm not actually considering doing this, but I would want to find out how many tables of the shootout are they going to play today. If it's just one, then I would certainly not do it, because the chances of my making it through would be pretty significant. If they're going to play two tables of the shootout, and you know, maybe one of the tables is seven-handed and one is nine-handed, in that case, you know, I think my chances of making it through would be quite small, you know, something like 5 to 8%. In which case, that I think then the cost is significantly lower.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought that there was no chance that the shootout would do more than one table today. So that's I think where our estimates diverge.
Your guess there is probably better than mine. So if there are only one table of the shootout, then it would definitely not be a good idea.
Yeah, I think I've done a lot more prop betting on the World Series than you have, and this involves sweating the World Series quite closely for a very long time, for years and years. I think usually they start with 10-handed tables, or maybe 9-handed, and some of those don't finish until very late at night, and people just go home. So, yeah. But,
okay,
you know.
So definitely not a good idea. We'll continue.
Recording. Yeah. I like the way you think, though. And in that case, like, things are going pretty well. I also think that, like, yeah, I mean, there's some chance you don't restart till like 4 p.m. and the Venetian starts. Like, there are ways to make it less bad. Like, if you can play until you get into the money and then really, really gamble it up, then it's not so bad, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I want to say one other thing that's worth mentioning. Our correspondent in Turkey, Gareth Chandler, confirmed on Twitter. So we're recording this the day after the terrorist attacks in Turkey. And Gareth confirmed that he was not, I don't want to say he wasn't affected by them, because I'm sure in some sense he was, but he was not physically harmed by them, nor was he in particularly close proximity to any of them. So for people who are worried about Gareth, as of today, Wednesday, Gareth is okay.
Yeah, and if you want a more up-to-date Gareth update, you can go to twitter.com/GarethChandler.
You should do that anyway, because you know, he was on here recently talking about his kind of current project, which is interviewing Syrian refugees in Turkey, and he's now got a website where he's been publishing some of the stories, and there's information about that on his Twitter account.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good. It's good stuff. It is stuff that makes poker seem... a little bit frivolous sometimes.
Yeah. But back to the frivolities.
Yeah. Well, which is also a profession for some of you too.
Yeah, so I've been hanging out mostly with Keone Young and with Carlos. Also with one of our regular commenters, Dana. I guess you and he correspond about bridge sometimes. So
this is Dana Rossi. He comments as Dana Rossi sometimes, right?
Okay, so it's okay to use his last name. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he like tweets. He's publicly
Dana Rossi.
I think he sometimes comments as Dana, but given his total volume of public commentary on poker and poker related things, I think he has no reasonable expectation not to be called Dana Rossi, so that people will recognize him better.
Yes, I've been hanging out with them mostly, but yesterday I actually got to meet Angela Jordison, the woman from Oregon who we had on the show. I think it's been a little while. I think it may be like in the 90s or something like that when we had her on.
It was just before last year's World Series, because it was like maybe 7 weeks before then, and everybody at the meetup was talking about how great she was, and the strong implication was that she was a lot cooler than either of us, which, again, I don't doubt. just over a year ago. It would have been just...
she was at the Venetian at the same time that I was, and she came over and introduced herself, and then she actually was kind enough. She was playing what looked like an extraordinary 1-2 PL08 cash game, and was kind enough to hang out with me for about half an hour on my dinner break. And she made day two of a PL08 tournament at the Venetian, which she credited us for playing the PL08 tournament. She said when she was on the show, she had mentioned not playing PL08 tournaments, and I think you encouraged her and told her she would have a big edge, and I think she has been having some success in them. So
nice. If
she wins this, we're laying claim.
Nice.
But yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah. Also, her Twitter feed is great in a different way. Like, her Twitter feed is mostly, like, sort of polite, friendly comment, link to a news article, polite, friendly comment, by the way, I'm crushing this tournament, by the way, I'm crushing this other tournament, polite, friendly comment, oh, yeah, I won 3 more tournaments. You know, it's good. Recommended follow. She's just a life crusher, I think. And speaking of people who talk to us, yeah. I have no good segue, but possibly the person who won the Monster Stack is a listener. So if you're out there, Mitchell Towner, and if we are the podcast guys who you credited in your post-win interview, it was really cool that you did that. And congratulations on the win. And I hope you keep on enjoying the academic life. It's refreshing to see somebody win a tournament and say, like, yeah, this was great. And now I'm going to go back to doing what I like to do, and that'll be fine. So good for you, Mitchell Towner.
Yeah, I'm guessing you're getting a lot of background noise from me now.
Only a little bit.
Really?
It's color. Okay. Vegas has a lot of miscellaneous.
For me, yeah, I guess there's some yard work being done just outside the window of my rented apartment.
Yeah, how's that going? How's the rental going this year?
It's a lot better than last year. the internet leaves a little bit to be desired, but other than that, it's great. And the location is primo. So I'm east of the Strip, and not too far off of Desert Inn, which on paper, I mean, just like distance-wise, I've been closer places before, but Desert Inn doesn't cross the Strip on land. Like, it goes up and over the Strip.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to worry about, like, Strip traffic with it. It almost feels criminal how easy it is for me to get over to the Rio, and of course, it's quite convenient to get into, like, the back entrance of Venetian as well.
Yeah, and if you want like a $6 foot massage, you can do that on your way over that bridge. That's the place I'm thinking about, right?
There's a lot of places like that, but I'd be curious to know. This is one of my plans for today on my day off. The place that I used to like to go to is closed. So if you remember name or details of the place that you're thinking of, I will likely go there today.
So last year or the year before, we were driving, and I was thinking to myself how nice it was to be going over the Strip rather than through it. And then, if I recall, just like right, it was on the south side of the road, and I think it was around there. You said like, oh, I actually like to go to that place, and the whole thing is like $10 or $20, even with a generous tip. And yeah, massages, you know, it's not just for people looking for more than massages. It was the point of your story.
Oh, yeah. No, so that place is not close to where I am. That's on the other side of the Strip, like, or it used to be, but it's closed, so I'm trying to find a new one. Yes, I'm not looking for a rub and tug. I'm looking for a good massage for $20 plus tip, which is very doable in Las Vegas, I believe.
I see. So here I've never paid for a massage in my life. You, like, it's really that much better than just taking a bath or something?
Yeah, you should try it.
Yeah, I don't know. I can be playing poker.
Well, you can do both, although those tend to be less good.
Yeah.
No, it's pretty nice. I mean, I resisted doing it for a long time because I had a feeling that I would want to do it more after doing it, which is true. But no, it's pretty nice. It's very, very relaxing, and I think good for your body as well.
All right. Good. Go you. Enjoy your day off. It's given that you're already spending some of it talking to me, like, it can't be that bad to go spend some more of it getting a massage.
Come on, you know this is one of my favorite things to do. I'm looking forward to your coming. When do you come out here?
July 3rd.
Oh, it's my flight leaves.
9:30 a.m. or so.
Yeah, I was thinking it was about a week away. I didn't realize how late it was in June. Okay, so yeah, you'll be here soon.
I'll be here soon. For the first time ever, I'm planning to play an event the day I fly across the country, and I don't care what you say about it.
What? That's ambitious.
Yeah, I've got like 3 hours of padding, and it's a PLO8 tournament. I don't know. I thought about the decision very carefully before I did it. And everybody who I'm selling action to, like, I put a disclaimer there. It's like, I am playing this tournament the same day I'm flying across the country. If my flight is delayed by a long time, I will have to late register. And you know that I'm waking up, flying from one time zone to another, and then playing a tournament, you know, caveat emptor. I feel good about it, though.
Which is, I guess, a fine time to mention for people interested in investing in either Nate and or myself in the main event. We both have action on stakekings.com.
Yes.
So you can bid for even very small pieces, I think as small as 0.2% for either Nate or myself. So if you're looking for either for an investment or even just, you know, a little tiny sweat in two of your favorite podcast hosts, you can find those on StakeKings.
Yes. Those are both there. The action is heating up a very little bit as I record this. So, you know, that's good times. You can also get a piece of the aforementioned PLOA tournament. Markup starts at 5% in part accounting for the fatigue. So, you know, we'll see. And if we're talking about PLOA and doing an ad, can I go right into the TPE ad?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so, or I can start the TPE ad. As I talked about last week, I have my first ever live play series up. It is PLO8. It is called PLO8 with Nate, or possibly Nate plays PLO8, or it has something to do with the fact that Nate rhymes with PLO8. And
how can you leave that on the table?
And if you've always wanted to see live play videos from me, you can do that. And if you're getting ready for a tournament series and you're either in Las Vegas, you know, looking to play live tournaments or high buy-in tournaments, or you're online looking to scoop up the soft online action while everybody else is in Las Vegas, you can get a lot of excellent material on TPE there. You have anything else to say about TPE, Andrew?
No. I do have something else to say, though. Which is that I want to give a shout out also. So we mentioned before Ryan LaPlante, who won the $500 PLO event, one of our guests. Also, one of our more recent guests, Michael Gagliano, also won a bracelet. I think that was $2,500 no limit or $2,000 no limit. Michael Gagliano also won his first bracelet this summer. And you know, as much as I root for anyone who's been on our show, basically, to do well at the WSOP, you know, these are two people who I would say in particular I was rooting for, in part because neither of them had won a bracelet before, in part because they're both, you know, extremely hardworking, even among, I mean, not that most of the people on our show weren't hardworking, but I think these two were particularly dedicated, and I think it was particularly important to both of them to win a bracelet. I think it was a really big goal for both of them, so I was quite excited to see both of them doing well this summer.
I also was happy to see both of them doing well. I think Ryan is they're both top notch people. I was really grateful to both of them for coming on the show. I interact with Ryan a little bit more online, and he's, you know, a class guy there as he is everywhere else. And I know that winning the bracelet was super important for him. Not that it wasn't for anybody else, but hearty congratulations to both of them. It was, in fact, a $2,500 no limit bracelet that Gagliano won. So
there we go. Sorry for trying to subtract $500 from your accomplishment, Michael. So other stuff that I've played so far out here, I played the Monster Stack, I played the $1,500 Bounty, and I played the 1K, just like that, you know, it's not technically a turbo, but you only start with 100 big blinds, so it ends up having a pretty quick structure. Didn't really get anything going in those. I've been posting a few hands on my blog, if you guys are curious about hands from those. There's actually some poker content on thinkingpoker.net. If some of you have given up on that, I have been posting pretty much every day since I've been at WSOP. I've posted some hands and some of the analysis that I've done on those hands, using tools like GTO Range Builder or Pro Poker Tools.
Can I have a couple in here for a second?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, your posts have been really good, and frankly, I posted this like really relevant and brilliant comment that nobody's responding to, and yeah, usually, I don't know what it is, probably everybody's too busy playing poker, but you know, the blog commentary, the chance to discuss things in the comments on Andrew's blog is much better than the chance to discuss things in the comments of almost any other place on the internet. And I hope people will appreciate the quality of the posting that you're doing. So run on over to Andrew's blog. It's really good. He's doing great stuff. He's posting on the internet when he could be playing poker, which frankly I don't quite get. But you know, that's what he's doing, and it's to our benefit. So there.
So yeah, I don't know if any of those hands are particularly worth our discussing now. I have a couple of kind of small, almost like stupid spots, but I think I think there's something kind of interesting here. I guess this has to do with like bluff catching, which in general, I think that, you know, if you find yourself calling large river bets, large relative to the pot, when you can only beat a bluff, I tend to think that you should err on the side of folding to those, at least against like non-elite players. I think just most people, and really, really like most recreational or kind of like low tier pro players, like tend not to be, like, I think they tend to be weighted towards value hands rather than weighted towards bluffs if they're unbalanced in the situation. So, I mean, if you find yourself holding a pure bluff catcher, even against a balanced range, your expected value is usually pretty close to zero on calling with those kinds of hands. And, I mean, this is situational, but I think that, you know, when you're really confused and you find yourself in a spot where you're just like, should I call or not? I tend to lean towards folding in those situations. And I had a couple spots that came up where I didn't fold, and my hand was a little bit better than just a pure bluff catcher. But there's sort of spots that irk me after I pay off in those spots, and they have it, and then I'm just kind of like, well, yeah, of course they had it. Like, they kind of always have it in these. Did you have a sense of the situations I'm talking about, Nate?
Yeah, and in fact, I wanted to sort of talk about that. Yeah, so I think there are places where a lot of recreational players overbluff, in part because they're not thinking about the board texture very carefully. Right. So like the common situation is like somebody limps calls, it comes eight of spades, seven of spades, deuce of diamonds, they check call a bet, turn pairs the deuce, they check call a bet, you know, or maybe it goes check, and then the river comes a queen, and they bet half pot or something. And you know, they aren't really aware that you can see that a million draws missed and that they're playing all those draws exactly that way, let's just say, up to the river. But I think in a lot of spots, the sort of Ed Miller adage that if people are bluffing just a bit less than they should be, then you should just fold all your bluff catchers. And that's good in that, in fact, in a lot of live settings, especially ones that aren't super high stakes, people do bluff a bit less than is optimally. And yeah, I agree. Like, very commonly, you know, it goes, you raise the button and they defend, and it comes a 7-3 and they check call, and the turn is a jack, and it goes check, and I don't know, maybe they bet the river. You know, that's a spot where, you know, they could be bluffing. They have a range advantage over you. You should be aware that they might be value betting a little bit light, but I think just the rate of pure bluffing there is maybe that's not a great example, but I think it is not what it should be. So I think that's right. I think if you hold a pure bluff catcher and it's not a case where people have some special reason to be over bluffing, possibly because they're not super attuned to what board textures are like and how public they are, then yeah, you should just fold your bluff catchers or raise with some of them.
Well, so here's an example of the kind of spot, and I mean, this is just like level one. It was not even a particularly big pot in level one. And I know it's kind of easy to sort of write these spots off as like not that interesting or not that important. But at the same time, you know, the river bet amounted to like 0.5% of a starting stack, not 0.5, 5% of a starting stack. It's a lot.
I wrote a book about this. Come on, it's they're all important, really.
So I have ace queen offsuit in the small blind. It folds to me. I open for 400, and you know, this is level one, but a likely recreational player calls in the big blind. And the flop is 3-4-5 rainbow. I again have ace queen offsuit. I actually think this is a spot. So I mean, I think check calling here is fine. I think though that your hand tends to be kind of transparent after you check and call the flop, like, or even just after you check the flop. I think a lot of people, even a fair number of like recreational players, if they're kind of experienced, it's not that hard to expect you to have an ace here quite often after you, you know, you raise pre-flop and then you check call a 3-4-5 flop. It just like, it strikes me as a pretty obvious line for an ace. I also think that like ace queen is still a pretty strong hand on this board. I think there's a lot of worse hands that will call a bet, including dominated ace X will certainly call a bet. So I actually chose to bet 500 here. I think the decision is pretty close, and with a weaker kicker, I'd be a lot more inclined to check. But because I do dominate a lot of the ace X that's going to call me, I actually think this is a hand that I can value bet on the flop. And there's some protection here as well. I mean, if he chooses to just fold like 10-9 suited or something, you know, there's a decent amount of value in that as opposed to giving him a free card.
Yeah, agree.
So I bet 500 into a pot of 800, and he calls. The turn is an 8, so the board now is 8-5-4-3, and I believe the 8 even completed the rainbow. And we both check. The river is a 10. I check, and he bets 800 into a pot of 1,800. And this is one of those spots where I was just like, I mean, there's not really a lot of hands I would expect him to value bet here, but at the same time, it really feels to me like a weird spot for him to bluff. You know, like I was kind of thinking on the flop, I was getting value from a lot of ace high, and I would think if he had just like a bear six or a bear deuce and he wanted to bluff, he might be more likely to do that on the turn rather than wait for the river. But then again, I also think there's very few value hands that he's checking on the turn, right? With the board being 3-4-5, I think that if he has a pair that he believes is good enough to value bet, or certainly if he has better than one pair, he'd be pretty inclined to bet the turn. So this just sort of like felt like a weird spot to me where neither value bet nor bluffs felt very likely.
Seems right. It seems right. That's very strange.
Any thoughts on what I should do on the river?
I think it's tough. I mean, so in live poker, there's this great thing where, let's say you have a pure bluff catcher, you might say, okay, people just don't bluff enough and fold, and that's fine. But then if it's close, like if in a theory vacuum it is close to zero EV, it's like much, much better just to try to get a read and go that way because people give off a lot. So I mean, my standard in this situation would be to try to get a live read, but that's not very useful.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I did try. You're a lot better at that than I am, but I didn't really pick up any useful fiscal information.
Yeah. Hey, boy, that's tough. Sorry, I forgot the exact rank of the river.
10.
10, 8, 10.
So, like, yeah. Ace 10 kind of struck me as the most likely value hand.
Yeah, that makes it worse than, like, Ace 9. I would think, yeah. And also, sometimes people will give you a goofy peel with, like, King 10. Although, if he's peeling you with King 10, he's probably also peeling you with, like, King Queen and King Jack, which he'll probably want to bluff with. Right. Yeah, that's tough. I think exactly on the 10, and given that probably all combinations of Ace 10 maybe play exactly like this, or at least a lot of them do, I think, relative to other things. Like, I think even a hand like, yeah, like a hand like Ace Jack, I think would just want to show down. I think given everything you said about bluffs being unlikely and most value bets being unlikely, I think that the sort of standard technique of trying to figure out if the river hit him is pretty good. I think the 12 combinations of ace 10 might swing it for me. I also think that sometimes ace king is better than ace queen here. It may not seem like it, but I do think sometimes people bet ace king just for no reason whatsoever. So I think I would like to fold ace queen. I think you'll have other things to call with, and I'd call it a close fold.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess it's also possible that he has like, I don't know that he would call 4x with these, but he could have like 10-3 suited, 10-4 suited, 10-5 suited, where he like flopped a pair that wasn't very good, so he didn't bet it on the turn, and then he rivered two pair.
Those
don't seem completely implausible either.
That makes sense.
Well, so I did call him because I don't know, because I called him. Sure. And he had queen 10 suited. So I think he had a backdoor flush draw on the flop, but it's still, I mean, I, in some sense, it actually made me feel better about my call because why couldn't he have queen 9 suited? And if he did, what would he do with it on the river?
Well, this is exactly what I said about king 10. You know, if he's got the king 10, then all of a sudden, like those 16 combinations add up very, very, very fast. If he's got queen 10, you know, what about jack 9? What about queen jack, king, king jack? Like, if you add in all those 16 combinations, then you're just too high up in his range to feel good about folding. And then, yeah, I would like the call a bit better. It's one thing if he just never bluffs, but as soon as that's in his getting to the river range, then I like it a lot.
Yeah, that was kind of my thing. So I actually, in some sense, kind of felt validated by the results, even though I sort of felt like I was paying off an obvious value bet. And you know, it is worth remembering, too, that when you're getting better than 3-1, I mean, as much as it feels crappy to, like, call knowing that you're probably going to lose, it is correct to, like, call knowing that you're probably going to lose. It's easy for your gut to tell you, like, I don't think I'm going to win this pot. It's not as easy for your gut to tell you, I don't think I'm going to win this pot 23% of the time or whatever it is that I would need to win here. So it's a little problematic to just go with your gut in these kind of situations. I do think doing the back of the envelope range analysis that we were trying to do here is worthwhile.
All right. So if I heard you correctly, you were saying that going with your gut can be problematic for the following reason, that you know, your gut is pretty good, or at least sometimes it's maybe good at giving sort of coarse-grained reactions, but sort of more fine-grained things like, you know, you're not good as much as 20% of the time. So like if your true chances of winning are, say, 30%, you know, that's still 70-30 against, and your gut is likely to give you the, you're a huge payoff machine if you put these chips in the pot reaction. And when in fact it would be correct to call. So a lot of the times you call and it's confirmed and that's, yeah. So you can't really trust your gut in that way when you're getting sort of long odds. Is that roughly what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. Or just like that kind of feeling of, I'm such a monkey. I just keep paying off these value bets. You know, it is correct to pay off pretty frequently when you're getting better than 3-1. Like that's not the worst leak to have in poker.
No, and especially when you're so high up in the other guy's range, so to speak, you know. And it's also different these days. Like, a lot of players really do just bluff sometimes. It's much rarer to find the person who just never bluffs. Like, 10 years ago, it was different, where there were a lot of recreational players who just plain didn't bluff the river. Like, they just didn't like to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's less the case now. So, yeah. So I like the call. The queen 10, I think, is heartening. I think there's somewhat less chance that he was, like, giving up with all those other hands and betting all of his 10s, you know. I think that's a bit unlikely.
Okay, good.
I mean, some people are like that. Yeah.
I had another one that I think was potentially an even trickier spot. All right, so here's the hand that I wanted to discuss. This is from the 150-350 level, and I have about 10,000 chips to start the hand, 98-25, in fact. The hijack open limps, the button calls, and I have pocket fours in the small blind. Neither the hijack nor the button is an elite player. I think the hijack was a somewhat weak recreational player. The button was a pretty strong recreational player. I wouldn't even be shocked if he had been a professional at some point, or I know that he had another job that wasn't poker, but he wasn't a fantastic, like a really elite level player, but he was quite good. You know, I just calling him a recreational player would really not do him justice. Like he seemed pretty comfortable around the poker table.
Excellent.
So I actually think there could be a case for just jamming this preflop.
What do you have?
I have pocket fours in the small blind.
Okay.
Facing a hijack and a button limp.
Yeah.
I really don't think there's much chance that they're limping better hands than this. So it's kind of like the almost worst case scenario is a coin flip. You know, there's some chance the cutoff or the hijack is, you know, getting trappy with like aces, but I think there's very few big pairs he plays this way, like maybe aces. In general, people are, you know, reluctant to play big pairs this way because they don't want to, you just have an overcard come on the flop.
Yeah.
So it's like there's some very tiny chance he's limping here with aces. For the most part, like I'm not going to get called by bigger pairs, I don't think. And I mean, I have to risk a lot relative to the pot. There's 3, 9, 10, 50. Like, there's like 18, 50 in the pot. So I'd be jamming about five times the pot.
Yeah, I think I like a jam. Like, and the people who limp or limp behind with sevens are often the kind of people who don't want to call off tons with it. So I think you take it down a lot. I think when you get called, it's by like ace, king, or ace, queen fairly often. When you get called, but that's pretty rare. The big blind will have a waking up with a good hand and calling range, but you know it's hard for him to have a better pair than you. And those chips mean a lot to you. I'm starting to think that jamming is the best play, actually.
Yeah, I kind of think I should just shove running over it now, but I didn't. I completed. I mean, I also think there's a lot of value in seeing a flop, too.
Yeah.
But you know, especially in tournaments, like you do have a disproportionate interest in just winning at a high frequency, like winning a medium sized pot at a high frequency is probably worth less than, you know, often losing and occasionally winning a really big pot. Or as happened here, well, I'll save the results for now. So the flop is king five deuce with two spades, and I have the four of spades. I check, and we check it all the way around. So this is a four people to the flop with a little under 2,000 in the pot. King five deuce with two spades. The king of spades is on the board. I have the four of spades in my hand. Everybody checks.
Yeah.
The turn is an offsuit six. So board now king six, five deuce. Still two spades on the board. I still have pocket fours with a four of spades. We check around, and now the button, who I said is the experienced recreational player, he bets 800 into the pot, which I think I said was 1850 or somewhere in that neighborhood.
So is it bad that I want to bet the turn?
No. I think that I don't think you're going to get called. I don't think you're going to be ahead of calling ranges when you bet the turn.
Right? That's right. Yeah, I think
so
that's right.
It's mostly protection.
And protection bet. You set up some double barrel spots sometimes. I think a hand like 9-7 will call sometimes, or 9-8 will call sometimes. I think sometimes an ace high will call you. And more than anything, I think a lot of hands that connect with this flop will bet it. Like, I think maybe not the big blind, but one of the last two players would have been likely to bet a king on the flop. I think they're unlikely to have the medium pocket pairs. I think you block some hands like 5-4 that would call you problematically. And you have an interest in taking it down. So I you know, just my first reaction was to bet the turn. But
yeah, that's fair. There is a lot of protection value in betting, because now we're talking about, you know, not just folding out one person with two live over cards, but potentially folding out three people with two live over cards. So yeah, I mean the risk is that, you know, when you do get called, I think you lose most of the bet. I think it's infrequent that you win the pot after betting and getting called. Even like the 9-8, 9-7 kind of hands that call you, you know, may bluff you out on the river. Then again, you don't necessarily have to fold a river bet.
You don't have to fold to a river bet. You have four outs to a gutter and two outs to a set. And I don't know. I feel like I've seen 1 million times people call, then it goes check, check on the river, and they have ace 10.
That's
like
true.
I feel like I've seen that 1 million times.
Yeah, that's but, fair. Okay, so misplay number maybe. Two, I check.
I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there. Just
But
it checks to the button.
I think it's
who
fair.
Bets something. And you shove it in his face, right? Yes. Yes.
No. Come on.
Okay.
The button bets 800 and I call.
Okay.
I think shoving here, so it would be pretty atrocious.
Not shoving, but like I can imagine raising. Like,
yeah. See, I think betting makes sense. I think check calling makes sense. I don't think check raising makes that much sense.
What do you put him on when he bets?
Probably a lot of air. I mean, I mean, I guess on the one hand, I'm tempted to say he would bet air on the flop, but I also, as you said, like, I would expect that he would generally bet. You just, like, he has a lot of protection interest in betting the flop too, and I would think that he would bet the flop at a pretty high frequency. Like, if I'm in his shoes on the button, I'm definitely betting this flop at a pretty high frequency. Like a really, you know, dry, hard to hit board in a limped pot with everybody checking to me, that should just be like an easy stab for the button with a lot of different hands. Bluffs, value bets, protection bets. Like, he has a lot of interest in betting there. I actually think, you know, he's slow plays. I mean, it's obviously you don't frequently flop sets, or I guess that's really about the only strong hand he could have here. But if he did happen to flop like a set of fives or a set of deuces, I would not be surprised to see him check those on the flop. I actually think checking those makes more sense than checking a lot of other hands. I mean, given that they're such rare hands, I'm not saying that they're like more likely than other hands, but I would expect that he would check those at a higher frequency than he would check other types of hands.
Yeah, and he should have other strong hands. Like, if he's worried about not having strong hands in his range, he should have plenty of like king five suited, king deuce suited, maybe even some five deuce suited or whatever. Like, it's not that hard for him to be doing, to construct a range that's got some value in it.
He could have turned a draw. I mean, 7-8, 9-7, 9-8. I would actually stab the flop with those hands, but I wouldn't be shocked if someone else was just like, I missed the flop, I check, and then like picked up a draw of some sort and then bets it when it's checked to him. Like, that,
yeah,
that's very plausible.
Yeah. So you think he has a lot of air, and you think that calling is better than raising against that range?
I think so, just because I'm going to be in such bad shape when the raise is called.
Yeah, it's fair.
It's fair. But yeah, maybe there's a case for raise. Like, I do have blockers to 4-3. I can, like, could rep 4-3 by raising. So, you know, maybe I can get him off of some better hands by raising, in addition to just protecting my hand. I might just be defaulting too much towards calling.
Oh, I don't know. I mean,
I'm noticing a theme in this hand that I'm consistently choosing the calling and checking option rather than the betting and raising option, which is fine when you have a better bluff catcher, but this is a pretty vulnerable bluff catcher. Like, there might well be more value in just kind of turning this into a bluff.
Yeah. Yeah, there might be. There might be. But like, also when it's close like this, like, there are reasons to raise, there are reasons to call. You might think the EV is similar. I really don't mind in a live setting taking the calling route that's more likely to keep me making the river, like, that keep me playing the river. Like, I don't mind putting pressure on myself to make a good read on the river. And even if check raising the turn is fractionally better, just calling, when part of the supposed disadvantage of calling is that my opponent has like hidden information, I don't mind putting pressure on myself to sort of unhide that information over the course of the river, or just to, you know, make a good value bet to do something else. So I like the call, check call. Okay, I'm on board. I mean, I'd rather bet, but given that you check, check calling, that's fine.
River is the ace of spades. So the board now is king five, deuce six, ace. The spade draw that was there on the flop came in on the river. I am holding pocket fours with the four of spades. I check, and the button bets 3,300, which is just about the size of the pot.
Ah, interesting. So I think that it's a little bit hard for him to have a hand, but I'm not sure he would bet bluff at this. I mean, he could be bluffing at this size. If you think that he has a lot of bluffs in his range on the turn, then when that river hits, I think a lot of people are going to think, like, that is a scary card, I will keep on bluffing. So that's good. On the other hand, that card might scare him into checking behind. Ugh. I think some of his bluffs do have aces in them, because some of his limping behind range has aces in them.
See, I don't think he's potting it with just
blocks and flushes.
Like, I don't think he
bet a lot of his flush draws on
like ace nine for value.
No, I don't think he's potting ace-9 for value. Do you think he's potting ace-9 for value?
No, which is... So that's part of the thing, is like... So for him to have a flush, he would have to have checked a flush draw on the flop. which would seem a little more plausible to me if he could have checked a flush draw with showdown value. And I guess he could have had, I guess it's a little bit relevant. I don't remember whether the five or the deuce was the non-spade. I know that the king was a spade, and I know that the ace was a spade. So like the nut flush draw is a hand that might actually make a little more sense, or that I would be less surprised to see him check the nut flush draw on the flop, because there's also a decent chance he has the best hand when he's holding that. Whereas when he's holding, say, you know, 8-7 of spades, he has a lot of interest in just betting and winning the pot, you know, either immediately or setting up barrels or something. It just seems like a somewhat implausible hand for him to have checked on the flop. So the fact that like the ace and the king are on the board, I think like I would expect that he would bet a lot of his flush draws on the flop. I think that on this particular river card with this sizing, we're really just going to see a flush or a bluff. I would think even a set is not likely to pot it on the river. So I really kind of think he either has a flush or a bluff. I have a spade in my hand. This seems like an implausible way to play flushes to me, mostly because of the flop check.
Yeah, what about like A6?
I mean, if I don't think he's potting sets for value, I don't think he's potting two pair for value.
Yeah. I think he might pot a set for value. I mean, your hand does not look much like a flush at all.
I just think most people worry that they're not going to get paid off when they make this. Like, I just think, I mean, and this again, like more elite players will do that. I guess I just didn't quite give this guy, I mean, not that I've been playing with him for that long, but which I guess also calls into question whether he can, you know, pot it as a bluff. But, yeah, I just didn't give him credit for, you know, making a big value bet without a flush on a flush card river.
In that case, bombs away, just call. Or maybe if you're worried that he accidentally beats you, which I think is unlikely given that you have a pair, then I might raise. But I think given that you have a pair and can beat most of his bluffs, then I guess you have to call.
Yeah, I did call, and he had 8-7 of spades, which it just seems... So it's one of those things, like, you can say, well, you know, maybe he should be checking the flop with 8-7 of spades if you're just going to, you know, pay him off when he makes a flush. Like, doesn't he have really good implied odds for making a flush? And the answer might be yes, that he does have really good implied odds for making a flush, but he's really giving up a lot by checking the flop with 8-7 of spades, I think. I think there's so much value in betting that hand on the flop. I kind of feel like even though it did work out well for him in this situation, I'm still not sure that he actually is doing better by checking the flop and then, you know, getting paid off for a pot size bet when he makes a flush as a result of his flop check. I'm still not really sure that he's doing better than just winning the pot at a really high frequency as a result of betting the flop. And like also,
yeah,
still,
that's right. And I think he should have some flush draws in his check behind range. I think that makes sense, but
they should be better ones.
Yeah, no, like I would not put 8-7, I would not put 8 high in my checking back range. I'd be more likely to check back the nut flush draw or a flush draw that had a pair in it or something.
I mean, that's kind of another way to console yourself after paying somebody off or after losing a pot. It's like, it can feel kind of dumb when it seems like it was kind of obvious that someone had a certain hand and you paid it off, or you sort of feel like, oh, I could have exploited him by making this fold, or I should have known that he had that or something. But you know, often it's like if they had to pay some really high cost in order to show up with this unlikely hand, which in this case I think he did, and the cost he's paying is in pots not won, that he could have won without a showdown that he didn't win. Yeah. So I think you can just kind of suck it up and say, well, you know, he kind of made a mistake and in this case got rewarded for it. But I don't feel as bad, you know, paying off in those kinds of situations. I equated it a
little bit it was just really unlikely.
He made a minus EV decision on an earlier street and just happened to like fall into a part of the game tree where that paid off for him. But I think, you know, if in order to have a particular hand, somebody has to like make a mistake at an earlier point in the hand, I think that paying it off, I mean, of course you'd prefer not to if you could really say for sure that that's what they had, but I think that if they kind of have to make a mistake at an earlier point in order to have a hand at this point, I tend to feel better about paying those off.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, you had the four of spades, like...
Yeah.
So you block 7-4 of spades, you block 4-3 of spades, right. Like you, yeah. Queen four of spades, yeah.
I really think I might have folded if I didn't have the four of spades in my hand. Yeah, I think the decision was close enough that that is really a relevant factor.
Yeah. Well, nice hand, I guess, except for all the stuff I didn't like. But you convinced me that checking and calling on the river is good. So nice work. And good luck tomorrow.
I'm glad we discussed it, actually, because initially the river was the part I was feeling least good about. And after talking to you, I actually think the biggest mistake is probably not betting the turn, followed by not jamming preflop.
So you're glad we're talking about it because you just wanted to talk about the river, but then your brilliant co-host raised all sorts of other considerations that's going to make you a better player.
Correct.
All right. That's good. I'll just figure that's exactly what you said.
All right. Well, sorry for all the technical issues.
All right. Well. Best of luck on day two. Best of luck at the tables.
Thank you.
The devotion of a car, the light, the fair passage of a bill.